Welcome back to the Crit Medic Podcast, where we bring together the worlds of critical care and pre-hospital care. I'm your host, Dominic Wallenzek. You know, we talk a lot about cutting-edge things here on the podcast. Ultrasound, finger thoracostomies, and so on. One of the most common refrains you'll hear people say is, "Oh, well, we can't do that because of liability." People on online social media say you can't do this or that because you'll be sued. Everyone acts like being sued is the be-all, end-all of EMS legal. But it's not. Worst-case scenario, your insurance carrier pays out to settle the suit, whether you did anything wrong or not, just to make the problem go away and you continue on your merry way. But there's an even more ominous legal threat: administrative law. This particular field of law is what can take your certification and threaten your very livelihood and ability to practice. Yet, it's poorly understood and virtually unknown. And a big part of that is the way we're taught EMS legal in our EMT courses. Usually, we have a regular EMT with instructor credentials who's been similarly misinformed by his instructors before him teach us about legal concerns. And often, it is poorly done. Our next guest is here to right those wrongs. Wes Ogilvie is a Texas attorney, but in addition to that, he's a practicing paramedic. He's also adjunct faculty somewhere and teaches about medical legal concerns. I can think of no one better to bring new listeners than Wes, the ambulance chaser who was so effective he caught up to and now rides the ambulance. He joins us from his BMW as he traverses the Texas prairies in search of his next legal victim. Wes, welcome aboard.
Well, one of the things that I hear a lot when I talk about law with EMS providers, first of all, they don't know as much law as they think they do. But there's a big disconnect between the fear of lawsuits and the fear of losing your patch. At least that's what we call it down here in Texas. If you get decertified, a lot of people will say, refer to it as losing your patch. I think we spend a lot of time worrying about the likelihood of lawsuits, which is a real concern, but a lot of states, including Texas, have pretty strict limits on liability for EMS providers in civil court. But the one thing that we don't spend any time talking about is an area of law that I practice in pretty regularly, which is administrative law. In short, administrative law is the rules and regulations of regulatory bodies. Most states, can't speak for New York or the other states, but I can certainly speak for Texas, we have a state law that governs the practice of EMS. And it's written pretty broadly, and overall that's a good thing down here, I believe. But no matter how broadly or how narrowly even you craft the law, it's not going to cover all the eventualities, it's not going to cover the details, the nitty-gritty. So you have to have administrative rules and regulations enacted by the government agency that's been designated to enforce that section of law. For example, with our EMS laws in Texas, it says that you have to have gone to a program that's been approved by what's now the Department of State Health Services. Well, it doesn't say in the law anything other than that. So the Department of State Health Services has to draft rules and regulations that say what constitutes an approved program. And so that brings us in kind of the two areas of administrative law that you see the most often, at least in state government. First is what we call rulemaking. That's how do you get the rules. And then the second is administrative enforcement of those rules. Rulemaking in Texas is relatively simple. The agency either determines that it needs to enact the rule or is told that in statute that it will enact the rule. And what they do is they put out a draft of the rule, and they put it out publicly. It's usually, in Texas, it publishes something called the Texas Register. And interestingly, federal agency rules and regulations are also publishing what's called the Federal Register. And they say, you know, here's this rule. We're asking for public comment. Please submit public comment within so many days. They'll get the comments. They'll take a look at them. And then they'll either revise the rules or what's called adopt the rules. And once the rules are adopted, they have the force of law. And then that brings us to enforcement now. So for enforcement, they are enforced by the agency that enacted the rules. And they can do basically two things. They can give you some sort of financial penalty, or they can do some sort of action against your license or certification. So if you do something that's against the EMS rules in Texas, you could be fined, or there could be some sort of sanction against your EMS certification, whether it's probated suspension, a suspension, or just even a reprimand. And in Texas, we used to have a state EMS magazine that the state published, and one of the first things people would always do is they'd go to the back, because that was where disciplinary notices were, and see who you know who got in trouble. They published that on their website now because the magazine went away a few years ago with some budget cuts. But the same thing's true as a lawyer. The back of the state bar journal has which lawyers have been disciplined and what they've gotten in trouble for. Now, there's a couple of interesting things on the administrative enforcement. The first thing is you have to have a license to have administrative enforcement take against you. At least you do down here. So, in other words, if you're holding yourself out to be an EMT and you're not, the health department can't sanction you. They would actually have to go to court and get a court order telling you to stop portraying yourself as an EMT. And then if you continue to do that, they would go back to court and hold you in contempt. The other thing is, in civil court, when we sue someone, it's usually for negligence or sometimes for intentional tort. You have to prove up that, especially for negligence, that there was harm to a patient. And in administrative proceeding, you don't have to prove that. All you have to prove is that the rule was violated. So there's been a lot of discussion on some of the EMS social media recently about a case up in Pennsylvania where the initial crew allegedly wrongfully withheld resuscitation from a patient. A backup crew arrived, they resuscitated the patient, and the patient ultimately died anyway. Well, from a tort law standpoint of proving negligence, you may have a hard time proving that the first crew caused harm to that patient, that they were the actual cause of that harm. But depending on how that state's rules and regulations are written, you might be able to get them on an administrative violation of something like they violated protocol. That may be in your administrative rules. In Texas, we also have a very generic thing about, I forget the exact wording, but basically acts which make EMS look bad or give EMS a bad name. Well, you might be able to argue that. I've been talking for an awful lot, and I've realized I've probably been going a little bit fast in this quick overview of the administrative law. So, Dominic, if you have any questions, I'm happy to try and answer them.
Absolutely, Wes. In the administrative law setting, do you have any sort of rights? Do you have the right to remain silent when you're in hearings for your certification?
Good question, and I'm glad you reminded me about that. Administrative law, the Supreme Court actually looked at this before. Under the Fifth Amendment, you have due process rights. In administrative law, they determined that those are the rights to notice and hearing. So they have to tell you what you've been charged with, and they have to give you an opportunity to be heard. In other words, there's going to be some sort of hearing. In Texas, usually the hearings are heard by something that we call the State Office of Administrative Hearing. It's a preponderance of evidence, so it's not as much as criminal court. It's more or less the same as civil court, and they try to follow the procedures of civil court.
Now, who's this ultimately decided by? Is it by a judge or a panel, or is it by a jury of your peers?
Typically not by a jury. And generally speaking, and I can only speak to Texas law because that's the state I'm licensed practice in, and I don't know any other state laws, although I'm pretty sure that in all 50 states, with the possible exception of New Jersey, murder is illegal. But in Texas, administrative hearings are heard by an administrative law judge. That's actually an appointed position. They're actually hired by the State Office of Administrative Hearing. And if you don't like what the administrative law judge says, most of the statutes provide that you have the right of appeal to district court in Travis County, which is Austin. So you can get into the state district court on appeal in certain circumstances.
Now, it doesn't sound like there's a lot of recourse for providers if they're found to be in violation and have their certification stripped. Is there a way that providers can go about regaining their certification if they've been stripped?
The answer to that question is one of my favorite answers in the law, which is it depends. You have to look at that state's rules and laws to see what framework is set for regaining certification. I've been practicing law in Texas for 14 years now. It's been in EMS for 12. what I found is that pretty much decertification is reserved for pretty much only if you've been convicted of a crime. And it's usually a pretty major crime. Now, there are drunk drivers who have their EMS certification still, but, you know, that's probably an entirely different topic about philosophy and what's justice. But the two sure ways to lose your certification are to be convicted of a major crime. And when you get the letter from, at least in Texas, you get the letter from the Department of State Health Services saying, hey, we've got some questions. The smartest thing you can do is reply to it. I would also say the smartest thing you can do when you reply to it is obtain an attorney.
I know a lot of insurance carriers offer to provide you an attorney for administrative proceedings as well. Do you think having like a malpractice insurance for each paramedic is a prudent maneuver?
I think it's a wonderful idea, and I'll give you a couple reasons why. In insurance, at least liability insurance, which is ultimately what malpractice insurance is based on one thing more than anything. It's based on what's called a duty to defend clause. That clause says that if you do something that's covered under this policy, the insurance company has a duty to defend you, and that includes providing a lawyer. So in a malpractice claim for EMS liability, you would get a lawyer. At least the insurance that I carry, HPSO, their liability coverage for me includes some representation for administrative hearings. So I get up to a certain amount of dollars to provide for a lawyer to represent me in any administrative investigation or hearing that a regulatory body can take against me. So I think from just having the lawyer alone, that carrying liability insurance as a provider is worth it. And more importantly, it's worth having your own liability insurance. Your employer may say that you're covered under their insurance, but you don't know what you're covered for. And hopefully the insurance is to protect them, not to protect you.
So you can only pretty much serve one master as a lawyer.
Absolutely. On insurance, I recommend that every medic have it, not just for the coverage, potentially for the administrative proceeding, but for the fact that even if your employer says that they have insurance and you're covered under their insurance, the reality is that the insurance doesn't cover you directly. You may or may not be entitled to an attorney. And if they think it's in their best interest to leave you in the frying pan, they can't. So you want your own insurance that covers you. At least that's a personal recommendation based on at least on Texas law. And every state's a little bit different in terms of what the individual liability of a provider is. But the one thing that I would point out is even if there is limited individual liability, it doesn't prevent someone from suing, and it doesn't mean that you won't have to get a lawyer to try and get yourself dismissed from the case. And then, of course, with administrative, you know, if the regulatory agency gets a report, they're going to probably investigate. At some point, you'll have to answer for that.
Now, over the years in EMS and law, you've probably seen some EMS providers say or do some cringeworthy things. What are some of the highlights?
I'm only talking about one that I heard about that by some miracle, and I mean this by an absolute miracle, did not end up in court or an administrative proceeding. It was actually swept under the rug somewhat. Two paramedic providers in a urban EMS system were dispatched to an asthmatic call, and the paramedics kept giving the patient nebulizer treatments, and if they were not working, this is the EMS system with two paramedics on the truck at the time, but that system did not allow for rapid sequence intubation. However, they decided they were going to sedate the patient to intubate them and gave Merced alone, which their protocols did not allow for either. Ended up being an unrecognized esophageal intubation. The BLS providers on scene kept telling the crew, you're in the belly, we hear sounds over the epigastrium, and you're not, and we don't hear any lung sounds. Crew ended up telling the BLS providers, you're wrong, we're in there, he's just tight. Somehow or another, entitle did get applied to this patient at one point, and they kept ignoring it because they said it was that he was a tight asthmatic. And that patient was delivered to the ER in a systole with an entitle of zero, according to the stories that I've heard. And the patient, as a good friend of mine has said, to this day remains dead. think that's probably the most egregious example I've heard of in a long time.
It sounds like that would run afoul of both tort law and administrative law.
Absolutely. From a tort law standpoint, you've got a negligence claim, and most states have a wrongful death statute as well. So you've got that. And from an administrative law standpoint, you're going to have all sorts of issues acting outside of their protocol. You know, again, that would never made it anywhere, but I think there would be liability for a lot of people and potentially also even civilly and administratively for the medical director, depending on what state laws would govern the medical director's obligation to supervise and provide QA and QI for that system.
So if you go against your protocols, would you usually see that end up in civil court, or do you think that would end up something more in an administrative setting?
The answer, as always, is it depends. On the civil court side, violating your protocols alone would not be enough to get you into civil court. You know, as a reminder, for negligence, you have to prove a duty to act, breach of that duty, and that duty caused harm. So you would have to actually prove all four of those to get there. Violating the protocols alone would not be actionable in civil court. From an administrative standpoint, absolutely. If the regulatory body found out about it or they received a report of it, and also depending on what the administrative rules are, but most of them, most of the administrative rules that I've seen, at least in Texas, do have, it is a violation of our administrative code to breach your protocol. And you theoretically get into an argument that if you go outside the protocol, that you could have actually engaged in a practice of medicine without a license.
So in Texas, you have actually kind of a unique setting in that you have both a certified paramedic and a licensed paramedic. Can you tell us what the difference is from, you know, both a practical and from an administrative standpoint?
The state law in Texas holds that a licensed paramedic is a paramedic who either has an associate's degree in emergency medical services or a bachelor's or higher in any field. A certified paramedic is someone who complete a paramedic course and pass the registry exam. Of course, for a licensed paramedic, you would have to pass the entrance exam as well. But there's no difference practically, other than the pass looks a little bit differently. There are a few employers, I know of several, that give preference to and or give a slight salary boost to licensed paramedics. I did not go through an associate's degree program, but since I already had my other degrees prior to entering EMS, I was able to become a licensed paramedic.
Huh. To listen to some of the online commenters, you would think that you could just get your law degree right off of Facebook.
They're working on that as an option, but we found that most Facebook lawyers have very limited ability to engage in legal analysis.
Can you think of anything else that you'd like to cover that we haven't already mentioned?
I think that, number one, all these stories, all these situations we see are incredibly dependent upon the facts of that given situation. And as much as they're dependent on the facts of the situation, they're dependent on the law, the jurisdiction. Texas law is going to be different than New York law, which will be different than Florida law. Each of these states are going to have very different law on that governs the practice of EMS, and that those EMS-specific laws even interact with other areas of the law. So it's very difficult, and I would even say dangerous, to look at these cases and draw very generic conclusions to them.
Wes, can you recommend any resources where people can go to learn more about law as it applies to EMS?
So, probably the easiest thing to do is start by finding out who your state's regulatory body for EMS is, and usually their webpage will usually have a pretty decent link to the laws that they operate under and administrative rules that they have. But again, like I said, there's a lot of other rules that may apply to EMS. For example, and I'll just give two from Texas. One is our state Medical Practice Act has some provisions regarding medical direction. Our Controlled Substances Act has provisions regarding who can administer and possess controlled substances. And then even you can get into the Family Code where it talks about who can consent for treatment of a child. So it's going to be really careful with doing legal research on your own.
Sounds rather complex. I think that if our listeners take anything home today, it's that, in general, EMS providers are rather ill-equipped to render much of an informed opinion on law. Just as lawyers are generally ill-equipped to render much of an informed opinion on the practice of paramedicine. unless they just happen to be an awesome lawyer paramedic from Texas named Wes, lifesaver and litigator. Has sort of a nice ring to it. If you'd like to catch more of Wes's musings and thoughts, you can catch him at his blog at theambulancechaser.com. The link will be down in the show notes. You can also catch Wes over at the EMS Mentoring Society on Facebook. After conferring with legal counsel, I will inform, but in no legally obligating manner, tell you that this podcast, hereforth referred to as We, has exhausted its self-imposed non-binding time allotment. We wish you a great week with no guarantee, either express or implied, on the quality of the aforementioned week. Until next time, Crit Medic listeners, you are under no specific obligation to keep thinking differently.